You're very welcome to the latest episode of African Research Excellence, the SW in Conversation podcast, all about the excellent research taking place in Africa right now in the field of global health research and innovation. I'm joined, as always, by my colleague and co-host, Augustine Martin. How are you, Augustine?
I'm good, Owen. How are you?
I'm good. Augustine, maybe you can introduce our guest for today.
Yes. So our guest today is Evelyn Kibuchi. Evelyn is a chief national coordinator of Stop TB Kenya, and she's also the Africa TB Caucus regional director. Evelyn is an expert in public health policy and advocacy, communication and social mobilization, media engagement, and coalition partnerships and community engagement. She's a sociology graduate from the University of Nairobi and holds a postgraduate diploma in journalism and mass communication from the same university. She's currently pursuing a master's in public health.
As usual, if there are any technical issues, be mindful of the fact that we're still recording remotely. Evelyn is in Kenya, Augustine and I are in Brussels in separate locations. So if there are any technical issues, please bear with us. And having said that, let's welcome Evelyn to the show. Evelyn, welcome to the show. Thanks for coming on.
Thank you. I'm glad to be part of this.
Maybe you can just tell us a little bit about yourself and the work that you're doing right now in Kenya for our listeners who may not know of your work and your organization.
Thank you very much. I am the Chief National Coordinator Stop TB Partnership Kenya, which is the advocacy arm of the National TB Program. Our goal is to take up issues with the National TB Program and address them through advocacy, mainly mobilizing other non-medical stakeholders to get interested in TB, on board the political leadership for increased political goodwill for TB response, bringing on board infected and affected communities, and also the civil society to play their role in TB in response in the country. I am also the African director of the Caucus, whose main goal is to ensure that countries are politically able to profile TB in their countries for resource mobilization and also for good policy environment at their countries. Personally, I've been working on TB response since 2007. I've been doing advocacy for TB. That's what I've been doing.
And what got you into TB advocacy in the first place?
Honestly, to say the truth, I was looking for a job, the advocacy. But what got me interested now to become more committed is when I got to doing TB advocacy, I realized there were so many gaps. One, first of all, people were dying of TB, a disease that I was told or learned treatable, it's preventable and it's curable. And my question was then, why are they dying? What can I do? And I realized with the skills I had, there's something I could do to change policy and to influence the government to bring a change and reduce the number of people who are dying of TB.
Yeah. And what was the answer to that question? Why are people still dying from TB if we have all of these treatments?
There are two big answers to that. One of them is lack of awareness. Because the question is, why would you sit to die for a disease that you know can be cured? You'll die because you do not know that this disease, what you're suffering from in the first place. You don't know that this disease can be cured. So you're either sitting at home just wondering what it could be, or there are reasons that are stopping you from going for that cure. And here is the barrier. I came to realize that the assessing treatment and TB services is stigma. Yeah, so stigma, thinking, oh, I could be having HIV, or people are going to think that because TB is associated with poverty, so I look poor if I admit that I have TB. And of course, okay, that is the people-oriented, you know, barriers. But now there was a policy and there was access to services, mainly because of funding, you know, shortage of funding, and also the infrastructure in our country.
And tell me, how much of that has changed since you started working on this in 2007?
Well, things have changed tremendously. I must say, personally, I am happy at the change that has happened. Let me mention a few. When I was starting to do TB advocacy, one, the communities infected and affected TB were not recognized as a stakeholders completely, as a stakeholder in TB response. Number two, the political leadership was in any way. I remember the first time we ever had a meeting with parliamentarians to tell them about tuberculosis. You know, they were totally blank and in shock and asking, really, why are you talking to us about tuberculosis?
Mm-hmm.
Three, the indicators has changed. I remember by then we used to have the 22 high burden countries. That's the target that we were working with, and the country was doing very well, very badly. I think by the time I was starting, we were like 18 out of 22. And in about 3 years, we had shifted from 18 to 15 to 13. So there's huge progress. And in terms of policy and research, I remember we didn't have MDR-TB treatment in Kenya. And there was those errors when we had the Green Light Committee coming to assess a country's capacity to respond to MDR. And we could only be able to put 40 patients on treatment. All those policy barriers have now changed. I mean, there's nothing like assessment by Green Light Committee. There's nothing like being put in waiting lists.
Mm.
Quite a number of new technologies that have come into the market, the gene expert. Yeah, a lot has changed.
And what's the situation now in 2020 in Kenya when it comes to fighting TB?
First of all, the country is still not out of the wounds. In fact, we are still placed among the 30 high TB, MDR, TB, HIV, high burden countries in the world. But effort-wise, I would say these tremendous change in terms of the infrastructure, political commitment, the involvement of different stakeholders, and even the community, even the level of community awareness has greatly changed. But the country is still in the bad books as far as TB, as far as the data is concerned.
Yeah. Augustine, do you want to maybe jump in?
Yeah. I wanted to dig in a little bit more into the role of research and innovation and finance for that, because Kenya is actually one of the best performing countries in terms of investments, domestic investments in research and innovation in the African continent. So I wanted to hear a little bit more from your side, how optimistic you are in terms of mobilizing additional domestic and international, especially European Union investments in research and innovation in Kenya. And what contribution do you think that could have in advancing, you know, the fight against TB, as you've illustrated a couple of minutes ago?
Yeah, first of all, I would want to say that one of the reasons why probably Kenya is doing very well in terms of research and development is we have outed that we have the infrastructure in terms of we have a well-established institution that's is involved in research for health. That is the KEMRI, Medical Research Institute. Number two, we have a very vibrant advocacy groups that do a lot of advocacy investment for health. And number three, I would also say there's a lot of support from the different stakeholders in terms of research and development is concerned. And even in the community structure-wise, I think we have the advantage of having, I would say, a landscape that is friendly to, for example, if trials that need to be conducted among the communities. For example, talking about advocacy, we have I would call it a movement or a coalition, which we call Coalition for Health Research and Development, or rather, in short, it's called CREED. This a coalition of different civil society organizations that are interested in advancing research initiatives that have come together to do advocacy around, one, funding for research, two, the policy environment that support a supportive policy environment for research, not just in Kenya, but within East Africa. So that's it was formed 2 years ago. I was among the founding members. It supported that path. So that sort of a movement really becomes very important in advocacy around research. And I think that's one advantage that we have as a country.
Yeah. And what type of approaches and activities have you been testing with the CREED Coalition and as you know, standalone organization? Because indeed, it's been quite interesting to learn about the work that CREED has been doing. And I think I agree with you, it's been quite successful so far. So I wonder, what have you done that has made a better impact that you know, other regions? What can other countries and other coalitions in other African countries could learn from the work that you've been doing in CREED?
First of all, sensitizing other relevant or interested stakeholders on the need to prioritize research in funding, and also pushing organizations to mainstream research as part of their agenda in whatever they are doing. Pushing for policy environment, again, within the African countries. But because I said it was just formed 2 years ago, so we cannot really say, okay, this is what we have impacted as CREED. But, you know, it's a process. So we are still in the process of trying to influence decisions, trying to influence funding, and also mobilizing other stakeholders to come in and support research.
And is this effort going beyond Kenya, or is this really focused on mobilizing Kenyan researchers? Do you have plans to expand it to, for instance, the East Africa community, where you are also very, very involved?
CREED is supposed to spread its wings throughout the East African region, and we have been working with other stakeholders within the Eastern African countries. So it's not an African thing. It's a unit for the East African region.
One of the issues, for instance, one of the activities I remember that was most shocking for me was specifically for TB was one campaign launched by AERAS on mining and the relation between miners and TB. It's a little bit old already, but it was very interesting to learn about how mining activities correlated or associated with increased TB incident. And in fact, the highest rate of TB in the world are among miners, which is more than 700,000 cases per year connected to mining activities. So I was wondering, how do you integrate health in other policy areas that are not specifically related to health? Because this is one of the greatest challenges for health advocates is to show that health is not just, you know, a standalone issue, but it actually touches all the different areas of policy. So how do you connect health with other policy areas, such as, you know, industrial policies or even mining policies or business policies?
Yeah, first of all, is to realize that, like you have just said, that health is not as... There are so many other socioeconomic factors that influence health. And like we say in TB, for example, that TB is... We would fail if we say that TB is a medical problem. TB is a socioeconomic problem. Therefore, if you address TB, for example, you have to address the socioeconomic factors of a country, for example, the housing, congestion, the nutrition, the access to information. All those are factors that influence health. Therefore, if you're addressing a health issue, first of all, you need to analyze what are the other factors that are influencing that particular health issue. And so even in research, much as you're going to do a medical research or a public health research, you need to look at what are the other socioeconomic factors that are likely to be contributing to that health issue. For example, the issue of mining, we may say that the reason why maybe miners are more predisposed to TB is because of the silica, right? It's a silica, right? Yeah, but look at the socioeconomic status of those miners. First of all, they have to migrate from their homes to come to where the minings are, the nutritional status. I mean, there's so many other issues that come into play. And so when you're doing research, you need to put those into consideration.
Yeah. I mean, I think one of the easiest areas where at least European Union decision makers have understand this and have understood this is the One Health approach, you know, the one that where you connect environmental, animal, and human health. And this is particularly critical, for instance, for antimicrobial resistance, which is an area the EU has started to prioritize more and more, and including, you know, efforts in research and innovation towards priority pathogens such as TB. This, for instance, one of the manifestations of this discussion is that the successor program to the EDCTP may include, you know, fighting antimicrobial resistance as part of the scope in the future. So I was curious to learn what's Africa doing and Kenya in particular doing in fighting antimicrobial resistance, which is, you know, very connected with TB, of course.
Yeah, again, it narrows down to, allow me to also to still say, the socioeconomic situation of a country. The problem of antimicrobial resistance comes as a result of, again, ignorance, lack of awareness. Of course, we know antimicrobicides, there are quite a number of reasons why we get to antimicrobial resistance. One, not completing the dose or taking the dose intermittently, using maybe expired antimicrobial drugs. And if the people are not aware of the impact of all this, then they will abuse these antibiotics without really knowing. I'll just take an example. We know once you're given antibiotics of any nature, you're supposed to take it. If you're supposed to take it as instructed, whether you stop feeling well or not along the way. But because we lack that that general awareness of how the antimicrobials work, the effect of abusing them, then you find often people misusing them. And one of the ways that we are trying to address that is doing a lot of counseling to patients that are put on TB treatment, so they come to know what will happen to me if I do not finish this drug. What is the long-term impact of that, not just to me in health, but not just to my health, but to the entire response of this particular disease for which I'm taking this antibiotics for, let me call them that. Again, it boils down to the level of information that the people are accessing.
The part of the information and sensitization is absolutely critical. And on that, I think it's also important, very, very, you know, pertinent to talk about the elephant in the room, which is the COVID-19 crisis, because there are many similarities between both, both diseases. They are both airborne diseases, and, you know, TB is the biggest infectious disease killer. What lessons do you think we are going to learn from this pandemic that could be useful also for tackling tuberculosis, or for, you know, learning how to deal with tuberculosis in a better, in a more scientifically based manner?
Yeah, I think COVID-19 has really come to enlighten us. And for me, it's really amazing the turnaround of research efforts that have been put since the first case was reported in December. And now it's barely 7 months, but we have seen so much investment, so much effort in research, so much efforts than we have ever seen in any disease response before. So what lessons personally can I say that we have learned? One, political goodwill. That political goodwill is very, very important for any disease response, from the highest level, you know, the state level to the lower government units in the country. If you look at how heads of states have come up very quickly to own the response of COVID at their countries, it's quite amazing. Again, the funding. For such a long time, we have been crying ourselves to sleep, advocating for investments, especially in research and development around TB, for example. But we have never seen the sort of response that we have that has been realized in such a short time. And I think it all boils down to the commitment. And yeah, it's just about commitment, because even the private sector all of a sudden have woken up and they want to invest not just in the response, but even in research and development. And number three, we're also learning that we have a lot of potential in our research and development capacity, especially in Africa. This is a sleeping giant that has come to be woken up by COVID. In a very short time, we hear, let me mention Madagascar. All of a sudden, Madagascar has come up with a cure, whether it's working or not. I mean, they have done something. Someone had to go to the lab and come up with something. Back in Kenya, I think Kemri also came up with some drug that for some cure that they are trying to advance. And in Kenya, we have students coming up with what I would call homemade these machines for supporting breathing. What are we calling them? Exactly, the respirators. In the blinking of an eye, other students have come up with a nap that you can have on your phone, and it is able to detect if you're standing next to somebody who has been in contact with COVID or something. It's really amazing, and we are learning that all through, we have a lot of potential that has been lying untapped, and we only needed a trigger like COVID for us to wake up and put it into use.
It's always like, as we said, if we go out to the etymology of the word crisis, which is Greek, and it means opportunity as well. And I think it's really telling that Africa is reinventing itself, I think, with this crisis. And we're seeing indeed a lot of innovators coming up with ideas to optimize the resources, you know, the talent that is in the continent to deal with this crisis. And this may be one of the reasons why Africa is comparatively doing so far much better than Europe or the US. And hopefully we continue in this trend in the future.
You know, there's been a lot happening on the international level in recent years when it comes to TB. Given your work in the Global TB Caucus and a lot of the international activity that's happened on TB in the last couple of years pre-COVID, how effective do you think that's been, and how optimistic are you that international work is going to continue now?
I'll do it to make reference to the United Nations high level meeting on TB that took place in 2018. And talk about how effective I think it has been or it's going to be. For a long time, we have been crying foul of low political commitment to TB response. And the only way we were going to win the war for political commitment was to reach the highest office in the land, which is at the United Nations. And there we have it, and there we got it. And we came up with all the ambitious targets. How do I think that they are making a difference? Yes, I'll say there is a huge, huge commitment, or they're going to make, I'm very optimistic that they're going to make an impact, because countries now have their specific country targets, which they know, or which they're gauging their performance at the country level against. So a country knows that by 2022, this is where I should be in terms of treatment success rate, case finding, funding, and all that. If it's prevention, for example, this is where as a country, this is a level we should have prevented our people from getting infected with TB. And I know countries have been very keen. Let me start with Kenya, if Kenya is anything to go by. But the National TB Program is very keen, such that even in their, even for example, right now we are developing the concept, the Global Fund concept note. They are very vigilant to ensure that we include the United Nations high-level commitment targets in that concept, because that is what is going to guide implementation. Even at the level of funding, countries now have targets that they are working towards. How much, how shall we have invested in TB? Even at the regional level, I know the African Union have had conversations around the funding levels for health and that effectively on TB. So we had lacked these. And now that we have something that we know that we are going to be judged against, then they have, the stakeholders have no choice but to ensure that we reach. I am very positive and optimistic that even if we do not probably reach those targets of ending TB by 2030, we have something that is driving our efforts. We are not where we were before. I get excited, for example, when I see a letter coming from the Office of the President to the National TB Program asking, where are we in TB response? That means that the Office of the President is definitely keen to know how the country is performing. So I know we are going, those high-level commitments are going to make a change. Let me come to the Global TB Caucus. For the countries that we have, an active parliamentary TB caucus, we have seen a great deal of difference, for example, in the funding levels, for example, in having TB discussed at the parliament level. We have seen parliamentarians taking up the step of them, for example, going to the communities and finding out whether the situation of the hospitals for TB, something that was not, that would not happen there before. Parliamentarians sitting together and discussing what is our role in addressing TB at our country levels or to our regional levels. Of course, that conversation acts as a catalyst for change in those in their own country. So I believe and I trust that engaging the parliamentarians in the conversation around health makes a whole lot of difference.
It was in the news everywhere that Kenya has finally managed to get a non-permanent seat in the UN Security Council. And the UN Security Council has not played a major role in global health ever, with the exception perhaps of the Ebola crisis, where they issued a resolution for the first time, and this actually improved substantially the international response in West Africa. So I was wondering if among your advocacy plans, you were considering engaging more prominently, now that Kenya again has a seat in the UN Security Council, in global health security, and in particular through that fora, through the UN Security Council. Is this something you are considering, or are you going to stick to the UN General Assembly, and it's not an area that you plan to explore?
Yeah, of course, we are still celebrating, and I must admit, as advocates, we have not had a sitting to discuss how are we going to leverage on this opportunity to achieve or to have health as a priority in this new position that Kenya has attained. And yes, it's a conversation that we are going to have as advocates and push that agenda through the president to ensure that health becomes a priority. But as of now, it's a conversation that we have not had, but it's an opportunity that we would want to leverage on. Advanced health targets at the United Nations level.
Okay, terrific. And maybe to wrap up, if there were one or two messages that you would like us to take home from that exchange, what would those be?
Yeah, I would want to word it this way. And I want, allow me to use an analogy of a bus. For Africa has a lot of potential for research and development in terms of skills, in terms of brains, and even resources, only that they have been lying neutralized. But the different stakeholders have to change their mindsets and look at Africa as a potential for research. And let me bring now the analogy of the bus. If you're waiting, you know, in my country, we use buses, and the buses have different numbers. If I'm waiting for a certain bus, I am waiting for that particular number to take me where I'm going. So my mind is set on bus number 46, for example, and I will not stop at any other, right? The same way for research, our minds has been set that research products can only come from the West. And so whenever we have a problem, we stand and wait for our bus. That is the West to deliver research and development products our way. We have never changed that mindset. So I would urge all donors to have a shift in the mindset and look at Africa as a potential for research and development. We have the right infrastructure. For example, if we want to have, if it's a trial that will involve communities, we have the infrastructure, we have the will, we have everything it takes for research. So let's have more investments for research in Africa, and we can deliver products that can be rolled out globally. And then I would also want to add that I've also noted that sometimes when products come from Africa, they take a bit of time, or sometimes they don't even see the light of day simply because of the mindset. And I want to give an example of I think it's Kenya that started testing the use of stool to test for TB in children. And we are quite at an advanced level. In fact, we are already factoring it as a diagnosis for TB among children. So that has this innovation has been lying there in shelves for quite a while without it being rolled out there. And my question has always been, has it been sitting in the shelves because probably it emerged from Africa? Supposing it had emerged from Europe or the US, would it have taken so long to be adopted? So for me, let's have a mindset, a change of mindset. Africa, we can do it.
On that positive, optimistic end note, I think maybe we can bring the conversation to a close. Evelyn Kibuchi, it's been fantastic talking to you and finding out what's been happening in the fight against TB in Kenya and in the broader East African region. Good luck in your work. I hope that we can speak with you again soon. But for now, it's been a pleasure. Thank you, Evelyn.
It was a pleasure talking to you.
And that's it for today's episode of African Research Excellence DSW in Conversation. Don't forget to subscribe to the podcast on Apple Podcasts and all good podcast platforms. You can find more information about DSW at dsw.org and across our social channels on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and LinkedIn. Until next time.